They crossed the border between Zimbabwe and northern Botswana, and 17 minutes later they saw the hired Land Rover standing exactly where they had left it, on the edge of the wide, white salt pan. My God, Sarah's buddies are still there. That's constancy for you. Craig made out the two tiny figures standing beside the vehicle. We'd better warn them, or when they see the government markings, they're going to start shooting. Sarah called down to the waiting Matabele through the sky shout loud hailer as they approached, reassuring them, and Craig saw them lower their rifles as the Super Frelon sank lower. He could make out the beatific grins on the upturned faces of the two young Matabele. Jonas had shot a springbuck that morning, so there was a feast of broiled venison steaks and salted maize cakes that evening, and afterwards they drew lots for guard duty over the two prisoners. They first heard the drone of approaching aircraft when it was still pearly half-light the next morning, and Craig drove out onto the pan in the Land Rover to light the smudge fires. It came in from the south, an enormous Lockheed cargo plane with U.S. Air Force markings. Sally Ann recognized it. That is the NASA machine based in Johannesburg to monitor the shuttle program. They're really taking us seriously, Craig murmured, as the Lockheed lowered itself to Earth. It has amazing short takeoff and landing capability, Sally Ann told him. Just watch. The gigantic aircraft pulled up in the same distance that the Cessna had used. The nose section opened like the bill of a pelican, and five men came down the ramp, led by Morgan Oxford. Like five sardines from a can, Craig observed, as they went forward to greet them. The visitors all wore tropical suits, white shirts with button-down collars and neckties, and they all moved with athlete's balance and awareness. Sally Ann, Craig, Morgan Oxford shook hands briefly, and then acknowledged Tungata. Of course I know you, Mr. Minister. These are my colleagues. He did not introduce them, but went straight on. Are these the subjects? The two young Matabele brought the prisoners forward at gunpoint. Son of a gun, Morgan Oxford exclaimed. That's General Fungabera. Craig, are you out of your mind? Read what's in here, Craig proffered the attaché case, and then you tell me. Wait here, please, Morgan accepted the case. Jonas and Aaron led the two captives towards the aircraft, and the Americans came forward to receive them. Peter Fungabera was still bound at the wrists with the nylon straps from the helicopter. He seemed to have shrunk in physical stature. He was no longer an impressive debonair figure. The cloak of defeat weighed him down. His skin had a grey tone, and he did not lift his eyes as he came level with Tungata Zabiwe. It was Tungata who reached out and seized his jaw in one hand, pressing his fingers into his cheeks, forcing his mouth open and twisting his head up so he could look into his face. For long seconds, he stared into Peter Fungabera's eyes, and then, contemptuously, he pushed him away, so that Peter staggered and might have fallen had not one of the Americans steadied him. At the bottom of nearly every bully and tyrant lacks a coward, Tungata said in that deep, rumbling voice. You did right when you stopped me killing him, Pufo. A clean drop from the sky is too good for the likes of him. He goes now to a juster fate. Take him out of my sight, for he sickens me to the gut. Peter Fungabera and the Russian were led into the interior of the Lockheed, and Craig and his party settled down to wait. It was a long wait. They sat in the shade thrown by the Land Rover, and chatted in a desultory, a distracted fashion, breaking off every now and then as the squawk and warble from the radio in the Lockheed carried to where they sat. They're talking to Washington, Craig guessed, via satellite. It was after 10 o'clock before Morgan came down the ramp again, accompanied by one of his colleagues. This is Colonel Smith, he told them, and the way he said it, he didn't mean it to be taken very literally. We have appraised the items you have delivered to us, and we conclude at this stage anyway that they are genuine. Well, that's very generous of you, Craig deadpanned. Minister Tungata Zabiwe, we would be very grateful if you could spare us a deal of your valuable time. There are persons in Washington very anxious to talk to you. It will be to our mutual benefit, I assure you. I would like this young lady to accompany me, Tungata indicated Sarah. Yes, of course. Morgan turned to Craig and Sally Ann. In your case, it's not an invitation, it's an order. You're coming with us. What about the helicopter and the Land Rover? Craig asked. Now, well, don't worry about them. Arrangements will be made to have them returned to their rightful owners. 3 weeks later, at the United Nations building, a file was handed to the head of the Zimbabwe delegation. It contained excerpts from the three green files and transcripts of the debriefing of General Peter Fungabera by persons unnamed. The file was rushed to Harare, and as a direct result, an urgent request was made by the Zimbabwe government for the repatriation of General Peter Fungabera. Two senior inspectors of the Zimbabwe Police Special Branch flew to New York to escort the general home. When the Pan Am flight landed at Harare, General Fungabera descended the boarding staircase from the first-class section of the Boeing, handcuffed to one of the police inspectors. There was a closed van waiting on the tarmac. There was no media coverage of his return. He was driven directly to Harare Central Prison, where 16 days later he died in one of the interrogation cells. His face, when his corpse was spirited out of the rear entrance to the main prison block, was so altered as to be unrecognizable. A little after midnight that same night, a ministerial black Mercedes-Benz went off the road at speed on a lonely stretch of country road outside the city and burst into flames. There was one occupant. By his dental bridge work, the charred body was identified as that of General Peter Fungabera, and 5 days later he was buried with full military honours in Heroes Acre, the cemetery for the patriots of the Chimurenga on the hills overlooking Harare. On Christmas Day at 10 o'clock in the morning, Colonel Bukharin left his escort of American military police at the Allied guardhouse at Checkpoint Charlie and set out across the few hundred yards to the East Berlin side of the frontier. Bukharin wore an American military-issue greatcoat over his safari clothes and a knitted fisherman's cap on his bald head. Halfway across, he passed a middle-aged man in a cheap suit coming in the opposite direction. The man might once have been plump, for his skin seemed too large for his skull, and it had the grey, lifeless tone of long captivity. They glanced at each other incuriously as they passed. A life for a life, thought Bukharin, and suddenly he felt very tired. He walked at last with an old man's short, hobbled gait over the icy tarmac. There was a black sedan waiting for him beyond the frontier buildings. There were two men in the back seat, and one of them climbed out as Bukharin approached. He wore a long civilian raincoat and a wide-brimmed hat in the style much favoured by the KGB. "Bukharin," he asked. His tone was neutral, but his eyes were cold and relentless. When Bukharin nodded, he jerked his head curtly. Bukharin slid into the rear seat, and the man followed him in and slammed the door. The interior was overheated and smelled of garlic, last night's vodka, and unwashed socks. The sedan pulled away, and Bukharin lay back and closed his eyes. It was going to be bad, he thought. It might even be worse than he had anticipated. Henry Pickering hosted the luncheon in the private dining suite of the World Bank overlooking Central Park. Sarah and Sally Ann had not seen each other for almost 5 months, and they embraced like sisters and then went into a huddle in a corner of the private lounge, trying to catch up with each other's news in the first 30 seconds, ignoring everybody else. Tungata and Craig were more restrained.
I feel so guilty, Pufo. 5 months, it was too long.
I know, they've kept you busy, Craig forgave him, and I've been jumping about myself. Last time I saw you was in Washington.
Nearly a month of talks with the American State Department, Tungata nodded, and then here in New York with the Zimbabwe ambassador and the World Bank. There is much to tell that I don't know even where to begin.
All right, as a start, Henry Pickering suggested, tell him about the dispensation that you prized out of the Zimbabwe government.
That is a good start, Tungata agreed.
First of all, my conviction and sentence under the poaching charge have been set aside.
Sam, that's the very least they could do.
That is for starters.
Tongata smiled and clasped his arm. That confession that you signed for Fungabera has been declared void, as it was obtained under duress. The order declaring you an enemy of the state and people has been rescinded. The sale of Roland's shares to Peter Fungabera has been declared null and void. King's Lynn and Zambezi Waters revert to you.
Craig stared at him wordlessly as he went on.
The Prime Minister has accepted that all the acts of violence committed by either of us were acts of self-defense. Everything from your killing of the 3rd Brigade troopers, who were pursuing you on the Botswana border, to the theft of the Super Frelon helicopter, and he has issued a full pardon.
Craig merely shook his head.
Then the 3rd Brigade has been withdrawn from Matabeleland. It has been disbanded and integrated into the regular army. The pogrom against my people has been called off, and independent observers have been allowed into the Matabele tribal areas to monitor the peace.
That's the best news yet, Sam.
Still more, Tongata assured him. My Zimbabwe citizenship and passport have been returned to me. I am allowed to return home, with the assurance that there will be no check placed on my political activities. The government is to consider a referendum on instituting a form of federal autonomy for the Matabele people. And in return, I am to use all my influence to convince the armed dissidents to come in from the bush and surrender their weapons under general amnesty.
It's all that you've been working towards. Congratulations, Sam. I really mean that. Only with your help, Tongata turned to Henry Pickering.
Can I tell him about Lobengula's fire?
Wait, Henry Pickering took both their arms and turned them towards the dining room. Let's start lunch first.
The dining room was panelled in light oak, a perfect frame for the set of 5 Remington paintings of the Old West that decorated 3 walls. The 4th wall was an enormous picture window that looked out across the city and Central Park. The curtains were open. From the head of the table, Henry smiled down at Craig.
I thought we'd better pull out all the stops.
He showed Craig the wine label.
Oh, wow, it's the 1961. Well, it's not every day that I entertain the current number one best-selling author.
Yes, isn't it wonderful? Sally Ann cut in. Craig was number one in the New York Times the very first week of publication.
What about the TV deal?
Tongata asked.
It's not signed yet, Craig demurred.
But my information is that it soon will be, said Henry, as he filled the wine glasses.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the toast. Craig Mellow's latest opus, and it's a long ride at the top.
They drank, laughing and festive, and Craig protested with his glass untouched.
Come on, give me a toast that I can drink as well.
Here it is, Henry Pickering held up his glass again.
Lobengula's fire.
Now you can tell him.
If those 2 women will stop chattering for 10 seconds.
Not fair, Sally Ann protested. We never chatter. We seriously debate.
Tongata smiled at her as he went on.
As you know, Henry arranged for Lobengula's diamonds to be placed in safekeeping and for them to be appraised. Harry Winston's top men have vetted them and come up with an estimate.
Tell us,
Sally Ann called. How much?
As you know, the diamond market is in a very serious depression at the moment. Stones selling for $70,000 2 years ago are fetching only $20,000.
Come on, Sam, don't tease us.
All right. Winston's have valued the collection at $600 million.
Everybody spoke at once, and it took a while for Tongata to regain the floor.
As we all agreed from the beginning, the diamonds are to be placed in a trust fund. And I am going to ask Craig to be one of the trustees.
I accept.
However, 14 of the stones have already been sold. I authorized the deal, and the proceeds from it were $5 million. The entire amount has been handed over to the World Bank in complete discharge of capital and interest on the loan made to Craig.
Tongata drew an envelope from his inside pocket.
Here is the receipt, Pufo. Your share of Lobengula's fire. You are free and clear of all debt now. King's Lynn and Zambezi Waters are yours.
Craig
turned the envelope between his fingers, staring at Tungata, struck dumb. And Tungata's smile faded as he leaned towards him and spoke seriously. "In return, there is one thing I would ask from you, Pufo."
"Ask it," said Craig. "Ask anything."
"Your promise that you will return to Africa. We need men like you to help stave off these new dark ages that threaten to overwhelm the land we both love." Craig reached across the table and took Sally Ann's hand.
"You tell him," he said.
"Oh, yes, Sam. We're coming home with you," she said softly. "That's a promise." Sally Ann and Craig drove up the hills of King's Lynn in the old Land Rover. The late afternoon had turned the grasslands to cloth of gold, and the trees on the crest of the hills wove delicate lacework against the high, serene blue of the African summer sky. They were waiting for them on the lawns under the jacaranda trees, all the house servants and herders from King's Lynn. When Craig embraced Shadrach, the old man's empty sleeve flapped against his skinny chest.
"Do not worry, Nkosi. I can work better with one arm than any of these puppies can with two."
"I'll make you a bargain," Craig suggested, so that all could hear. "I will lend you an arm if you will lend me a leg." And Shadrach laughed until the tears dripped onto his shirt, and his newest and youngest wife had to lead him away. Joseph waited on the wide veranda, aloof from the common throng, resplendent in snowy white kanza, and with the tall chef's cap on his head.
"I see you, Nkosikasi,"
he greeted Sally Ann gravely, as she reached the top of the stairs. But he could not disguise the sparkle of pleasure in his eyes.
"I see you also, Joseph, and I have decided we will have 200 guests at the wedding,"
she answered him in fluent Sindabelli. And Joseph covered his mouth with both hands in astonishment, the first time she had ever seen him off balance.
"How?"
he said, and then turned to his underlings.
"Now we have a truly great lady at Kingilingi, who understands all your monkey chatter,"
he told them sternly.
"So woe unto any of you who lie or cheat or steal."
Craig and Sally Ann stood at the top of the stairs, holding hands while the people of King's Lynn sang the song that welcomes the traveller home after a long and dangerous journey. And when it was ended, Craig looked down at her.
"Welcome home, my darling," he said.
And while the women ululated and danced, so that the heads of the infants strapped to their backs jerked like little black puppets, and the men roared approval, Craig kissed her on the mouth.